Lee, I can't discuss his condition since you're not family, he said.
But he's going to be okay, right?
The doctor looked from one to the other.
By all rights, you shouldn't even be here.
You did the right thing by calling the ambulance, and I'm glad you found him when you did, but you don't have any further responsibility. You're strangers.
Sophia looked at the doctor, sensing he had more to say, watching as he finally sighed.
I don't really know what's going on here, Dr. Dillon said. But for whatever reason, when Mr. Levinson heard you were here, he asked to see you. I can't tell you anything about his condition, but I must ask that you keep the visit as short as possible.
Ira appeared even smaller than he had in the car, as though he'd shrunk in the last few hours. He lay in the partially reclined hospital bed, his mouth agape, his cheeks hollow, IV lines snaking out of his arm. A machine next to his bed was beeping in rhythm to his heart.
Not too long, the doctor warned, and Luke nodded before the two of them entered the room.
Hesitating, Sophia moved to the side of the bed. From the corner of her eye, she saw Luke pull a chair away from the wall and slide it toward her before stepping back again. Sophia took a seat by the bed and leaned into his field of vision.
We're here, Ira, she said, holding the letter in front of him. I have your letter for you.
Ira inhaled with some effort, slowly rolling his head. His eyes went first to the letter, and then to her.
Ruth.
Yes, she said. Your letter to Ruth. I'm going to put it right here beside you, okay?
At her comment, he stared without focus, uncomprehending. Then his face softened, becoming almost sad. He moved his hand slightly, trying to reach hers, and on instinct she reached over and took it.
Ruth,
he said, tears beginning to form.
My sweet Ruth.
I'm sorry. I'm not Ruth, she said softly. My name is Sophia. We're the ones who found you today.
He blinked, then blinked again, his confusion evident.
Ruth.
The plea in his tone made her throat tighten.
No,
she said quietly, watching as he moved his hand and inched it toward the letter. She understood what he was doing and slid the letter toward him. He took it, lifting it as though it were an enormous weight, pushing it toward her hand. Only then did she notice Ira's tears. When he spoke, his voice sounded stronger, the words clear for the first time.
Can you be?
She fingered the letter.
You want me to read this? The letter you wrote to your wife?
His gaze met her eyes, a tear spilling down his shrunken cheek.
Please, Ruth. I want you to read it.
He exhaled a long breath, as if the effort of speaking had worn him out. Sophia turned toward Luke, wondering what she should do. Luke pointed toward the letter.
I think you should read it, Ruth, he said to her. It's what he wants you to do. Read it aloud so he can hear you.
Sophia stared at the letter in her hands.
It felt wrong. Ira was confused. It was a personal letter. Ruth was supposed to read this, not her.
Please,
she heard Ira say, as if reading her mind, his voice weakening again. With trembling hands, Sophia studied the envelope before lifting the seal. The letter was a single page long, written in the same shaky scrawl she'd noticed on the envelope. Though still uncertain, she found herself moving the letter into better light. And with that, she slowly began to read.
My darling Ruth, it is early, too early, but as always it seems I'm unable to go back to sleep. Outside, the day is breaking in all its newfound glory, and yet all I can think about is the past. In this silent hour, I dream of you and the years we spent together. An anniversary is approaching, dear Ruth, but it is not the one we usually celebrate. It is, however, the one that set in motion my life with you, and I turn to your seat, wanting to remind you of this, even though I understand that you will not be there. God, with a wisdom I can't claim to understand, called you home a long time ago, and the tears I shed that night have never seemed to dry.
Sophia stopped to look at Ira, noting the way his lips had come together, tears still leaking into the crevices and valleys of his face. Though she tried to remain poised, her voice began to crack as she went on.
I miss you this morning, just as I have missed you every day for the last 9 years. I'm tired of being alone. I'm tired of living without the sound of your laughter, and I despair at the thought that I can never hold you again. And yet it would please you to know that when these dark thoughts threaten to overtake me, I can hear your voice chiding me. Do not be so gloomy, Ira. I did not marry a gloomy man. When I think back, there is so much to remember. We had adventures, yes? These are your words, not mine, for this is how you always described our lives together. You said this to me while lying beside me in bed. You said this to me on Rosh Hashanah every single year. I always detected a satisfied gleam in your eye whenever you said this, and in those moments it was your expression more than your words that always filled my heart with joy. With you, my life felt indeed like a fantastic adventure. Despite our ordinary circumstances, your love imbued everything we did with secret riches. How I was lucky enough to share a life with you, I still cannot understand. I love you now, just as I have always loved you, and I'm sorry that I'm not able to tell you. And though I write this letter in the hope that you'll somehow be able to read it, I also know that the end of an era approaches. This, my darling, is the last letter I will write you. You know what the doctors have told me. You know that I'm dying, and that I will not visit Black Mountain in August. And yet I want you to know that I'm not afraid. My time on Earth is ending, and I'm at peace with whatever comes. I'm not saddened by this. If anything, it fills me with peace, and I count the days with a sense of relief and gratitude. For every day that passes is one day closer to the moment I will see you again. You are my wife, but more than that, you have always been my one true love. For nearly 3/4 of a century, you have given my existence meaning. It is time now to say goodbye, and on the cusp of this transition, I think I understand why you were taken away. It was to show me how special you were, and through this long process of grieving, to teach me again the meaning of love. Our separation, I now understand, has only been temporary. When I gaze into the depths of the universe, I know the time is coming when I will hold you in my arms once more. After all, if there is a heaven, we will find each other again. But there is no heaven without you. I love you, Ira.
Through a blur of tears, Sophia watched Ira's face assume an expression of indescribable peace. Carefully, she reinserted the letter into the envelope. She slid it into his hand and felt him take it back. By then, the doctor was standing at the door, and Sophia knew it was time to go. She rose from the chair, and Luke returned it to its place against the wall, then slipped his hand into hers. As he turned his head on the pillow, Ira's mouth fell open, and his breathing became labored. Sophia turned to the doctor, who was already on his way to Ira's side. With one last glance back at Ira's frail figure, Sophia and Luke started down the corridor, on their way home at last. 31. Luke. As February passed and gradually wound down, Sophia edged toward graduation, while the ranch inched toward its inevitable foreclosure. Luke's winnings in the first 3 events had bought his mother and him another month or two before they defaulted, but at the end of the month his mother quietly began to approach their neighbors, exploring their interest in buying her out. Sophia was beginning to worry concretely about her future. She hadn't heard from either the Denver Art Museum or MoMA yet, and she wondered whether she'd find herself working for her parents and living in her old bedroom. Similarly, Luke was having a hard time sleeping. He worried about his mother's options in the area and wondered how he could help support her until she landed something viable. For the most part, however, neither of them wanted to talk about the future. Instead, they tried to focus on the present, seeking comfort in each other's company and the certainty of the way they felt about each other. By March, Sophia was showing up at the ranch on Friday afternoons and staying until Sunday. Often, she spent Wednesday nights there as well. Unless it was raining, they spent most of their time on horseback. Sophia usually assisted Luke with his farm duties, but occasionally she'd keep his mother company instead. It was the kind of life he'd always envisioned for himself. And then he'd remember that it was coming to an end, and there was nothing he could do to stop it. One evening in mid-March, when the first hint of spring was noticeable in the air, Luke took Sophia to a club featuring a popular country western band. Across the scuffed wooden table, he watched her grip her beer, her foot tapping along with the music.
"You keep that up,"
he said, nodding toward her foot,
"and I'll think you like this music."
"I do like this music," he smiled.
"You've heard that joke, right? About what you get when you play country music backwards?"
She took a swallow of her beer.
"I don't think so." "You get your wife back, you get your dog back, you get your truck back."
She smirked. "That's funny."
"You didn't laugh." "It wasn't that funny."
That made him laugh.
"You and Marcia still getting along?"
Sophia tucked a loose strand of hair behind her ear. "It was kind of awkward at first, but it's almost back to normal."
"Is she still dating Brian?"
She snorted.
"No, that ended when she found out he was cheating on her." "When did this happen?"
"A couple of weeks ago, maybe a little more."
"Was she upset?"
"Not really. By then, she was already seeing another guy, too. He's only a junior, so I'm not thinking it's going to last." Luke picked absently at the label on his bottle of beer.
"She's an interesting girl."
"She's got a good heart," Sophia insisted.
"And you're not mad about what she did?"
"I was, but I'm over it."
"Just like that?"
"She made a mistake. She didn't mean to hurt me. She's apologized a million times, and she came through when I needed her. So, yes, just like that, I'm over it."
"Do you think you'll keep in contact with her after you graduate?"
"Of course. She's still my best friend." "And you should like her, too."
"Why is that?"
He cocked an eyebrow. "Because without her," she said, "I never would have met you." A few days later, Luke accompanied his mom to the bank to propose a renegotiated payment plan that would allow them to keep the ranch. His mom presented a business plan that included selling nearly half the ranch, including the Christmas tree grove, the pumpkin patch, and one of the pastures, assuming a buyer could be found. They'd decrease the herd by a third, but according to her calculations, they'd be able to meet the reduced payments on the loan. 3 days later, the bank formally rejected the offer. One Friday night at the end of the month, Sophia showed up at the ranch visibly upset. Her eyes were red and swollen, and her shoulders slumped in despair. Luke put his arms around her as soon as she reached the porch.
"What's wrong?"
He heard her sniff, and when she spoke, her voice shook. "I couldn't wait any longer," she said. "So I called the Denver Art Museum and I asked if they'd had a chance to review my application. They said that they had and that the internship had already been filled. And the exact same thing happened when I called MoMA."
"I'm sorry,"
he said, rocking her in his arms.
"I know how much you were hoping for one of them."
Finally, she pulled back, anxiety etched on her face. "What am I going to do? I don't want to go back to my parents. I don't want to work at the deli again." He was about to tell her that she could stay here with him for as long as she wanted, when he suddenly remembered that wasn't going to be possible either. In early April, Luke watched his mom give a tour of the property to three men. He recognized one of them as a rancher near Durham. They'd talked once or twice at cattle auctions, and Luke didn't have any sense of the man, though it was obvious even from a distance that his mom didn't much care for him. Whether it was a personal dislike or the fact that the loss of the ranch was getting closer to reality, Luke couldn't tell. The other two, he suspected, were either relatives or business partners. That night over dinner, his mom said nothing about it, and he didn't ask. Although Luke had ridden in only three of the first seven events of the year, he'd earned enough points to find himself in fifth place by the cutoff date, enough to qualify him for the Major League Tour. The following weekend in Chicago, there was an event with enough prize money at stake to keep the ranch afloat until the end of the year, assuming he rode as well as he had at the start of the season. Instead, he kept his word to both Sophia and his mom. The mechanical bull in the barn stayed covered, and another rider went on to the big tour in his place, no doubt dreaming of winning it all.
Any regrets? Sophia asked him.
About not riding this weekend? On a whim, they'd driven to Atlantic Beach beneath a blue and cloudless sky. At the shore, the breeze was cool but not biting, and the beach was peppered with people walking or flying kites. A few intrepid surfers were riding the long, rolling waves to shore.
None,
he said without hesitation. They walked a few steps, Luke's feet slipping in the sand.
I'll bet you would have done okay.
Probably.
Do you think you could have won?
Luke thought for a moment before answering, his eyes fixed on a pair of porpoises gliding through the water.
Maybe, he said, but probably not. There are some pretty talented riders on the circuit.
Sophia came to a stop and looked up at Luke.
I just realized something.
What's that?
When you were riding in South Carolina, you said you'd drawn Big Ugly Critter in the finals.
He nodded.
You never told me what happened.
No,
he said, still watching the porpoises.
I guess I didn't, did I?
A week later, the three men who'd toured the ranch returned, then spent half an hour in his mom's kitchen. Luke suspected they were presenting an offer of some sort, but he didn't have the heart to go over and find out. Instead, he waited until they were gone. He found his mom still sitting at the kitchen table when he entered. She looked up at him without saying anything. Then she simply shook her head.
What are you doing next Friday? Sophia asked. Not tomorrow, but the one after that.
It was a Thursday night, just a month shy of graduation, the first and probably last time Luke would find himself at a club surrounded by a gaggle of sorority girls. Marcia was there too, and though she'd greeted Luke, she was far more interested in the dark-haired boy who'd met them there. He and Sophia practically had to shout to be heard over the relentless bass of the music.
I don't know. Working, I guess, he said. Why?
Because the department chair, who also happens to be my advisor, snagged me invitations to an art auction and I want you to come.
He leaned over the table.
Did you say art auction?
It's supposed to be incredible, a once-in-a-lifetime thing. It'll be held at the Greensboro Convention Center and it's being run by one of the big auction houses from New York. Supposedly, some obscure guy from North Carolina accumulated a world-class collection of modern art. People are flying in from all over the world to bid. Some of the artwork is supposed to be worth a fortune.
And you want to go?
Hello? It's art? Do you know the last time an auction of this caliber occurred around here?
Never.
How long's it going to last?
I have no idea. I've never been to an auction before, but just so you know, I'm going. And it would be nice if you came along. Otherwise, I'm going to have to sit with my advisor, and I know for a fact that he's bringing along another professor from the department, which means they'll spend the whole time talking to each other. And let's just say if that happens, I'll probably be in a bad mood and might have to stay at the sorority house all weekend just to recover.
If I didn't know you better, I'd say you were threatening me.
It's not a threat. It's just something to keep in mind.
And if I keep it in mind and still say no,
then you're going to be in trouble too.
He smiled.
If it's important to you, I wouldn't miss it for the world.
Luke wasn't sure why he hadn't noticed before, but it struck him at some point that getting started on the day's work had become more and more difficult as time passed. The maintenance work on the ranch had begun to suffer, not because it wasn't important, he realized, but because he had little motivation. Why replace the sagging porch railings at his mom's place? Why fill in the sinkhole that had formed near the irrigation pump? Why fill in the potholes in the long gravel drive that had grown deeper over the winter? Why do anything when they weren't going to be living here much longer? He'd supposed that his mom had been immune to those sorts of feelings, that she had a strength he hadn't inherited. But as he'd ridden out to check the cattle that morning, something about his mom's property had caught his attention, and he had pulled horse to a stop. His mother's garden had always been a source of pride to her. Even as a toddler, he could remember watching as she readied it for the spring planting or weeded it with painstaking care during the summer, harvesting the vegetables at the end of a long day. But now, as he looked out at what should have been straight, neat rows, he realized that the plot was overrun by weeds.
Okay, so about this Friday.
Sophia rolled over in bed to face him. Keep in mind that it's an art auction. It was only 2 days away, and he tried to come across as properly attentive.
Yes, you told me.
Lots of rich people there. Important people.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure you weren't planning to wear your hat and boots.
I figured.
You're going to need a suit.
I have a suit,
he said.
A nice one, in fact.
You have a suit? Her eyebrows shot up.
Why do you sound so surprised?
Because I can't imagine you in a suit. I've only ever seen you in jeans.
Not true, he winked. I'm not wearing any jeans now.
Get your mind out of the gutter, she said, not wanting even to acknowledge his comment. That's not what I'm talking about, and you know it. He laughed.
I bought a suit 2 years ago. And a tie and a shirt and shoes, if you must know. I had to go to a wedding.
And let me guess, that's the only time you've ever worn it, right?
No,
he said, shaking his head.
I wore it again.
Another wedding, she asked.
A funeral, he said. A friend of my mom's.
That was my second guess, she said, hopping out of bed. She grabbed the throw blanket, wound it around herself, and tucked in the corner like a towel. I want to see it. Is it in your closet?
Hanging on the right.
He pointed, admiring her shape in the makeshift toga. She opened the closet door and pulled out the hanger, taking a moment to inspect it. You're right, she said. It's a nice suit.
There you go, sounding all surprised again.
Still holding the suit, she looked over at him. Wouldn't you be? In the morning, Sophia returned to campus while Luke rode off to inspect the herd. They'd made plans for him to pick her up the following day. To his surprise, he found her sitting on his porch when he got home later that afternoon. She was clutching a newspaper, and when she faced him, there was something haunted in her expression.
What's wrong?
He asked. It's about Ira, she said. Ira Levinson. It took a second for the name to come back to him.
You mean the guy we rescued from his car?
She held out the newspaper. Read this. He took the paper from her and scanned the headline, which described the auction that was to take place the next day. Luke furrowed his brow, puzzled.
This is an article about the auction.
The collection is Ira's, she said. It was all there in the article, or a lot of it was anyway. There were fewer personal details than he would have expected, but he learned a bit about Ira's shop, and the article noted the date of his marriage to Ruth. It mentioned that Ruth had been a school teacher and that they'd begun to collect modern art together after the end of World War II. They'd never had children. The remainder of the article concerned the auction and the pieces that were going to be offered, most of which meant nothing to Luke. It concluded, however, with a line that gave him pause, affecting him the same way it had Sophia. Sophia brought her lips together as he reached the end of the article.
He never made it out of the hospital, she said, her voice soft. He died from his injuries the day after we found him.
Luke raised his eyes to the sky, closing them for a moment. There was nothing really to say.
We were the last people to see him, she said. It doesn't say that, but I know it's true. His wife was dead, they had no kids, and he'd pretty much become a hermit. He died alone, and the thought of that just breaks my heart. Because...
When she trailed off, Luke drew her near, thinking about the letter Ira had written to his wife.
I know why,
Luke said.
Because it kind of breaks my heart, too.
32. Sophia. Sophia had just finished putting in her earrings on the day of the auction when she saw Luke's truck come to a stop in front of the house. Though she'd teased Luke earlier about having only a single suit, in truth, she owned only two, both with mid-length skirts and matching jackets. And she'd purchased those only because she'd needed something classy and professional to wear to interviews. At the time, she'd worried that two wouldn't suffice, what with all the interviews she'd no doubt line up. Which made her think about that old saying. How did it go? People plan, God laughs, or something like that. As it was, she'd worn each of them once. Knowing that Luke's suit was dark, she'd opted for the lighter of the two. Despite her early enthusiasm, she now felt strangely ambivalent about going to the auction. Discovering that it was Ira's collection made it more personal somehow, and she feared that with every painting, she'd recall how he'd appeared as she'd read his letter in the hospital. Yet to not go seemed disrespectful, since the collection obviously meant so much to him and his wife. Still feeling conflicted, she left her room and went downstairs.
Luke was waiting just inside the foyer.
Are you ready for this?
I guess, she temporized. It's different now.
I know. I thought about Ira most of the night.
Me too.
He forced a smile, though there wasn't a lot of energy behind it.
You look terrific, by the way. You're all grown up.
You too, she said, meaning it. But why do I feel like we're going to a funeral? She asked him.
Because, he said, in a way, we are.
They entered one of the enormous exhibition rooms at the convention center an hour before noon. It was nothing like she'd expected. At the far end of the room was a stage surrounded by curtains on three sides. On the right were two long tables on elevated daises, each bearing 10 telephones. On the other side stood the podium, no doubt for the auctioneer. A large screen formed the backdrop on the stage, and at the very front stood an empty easel. Approximately 300 chairs faced the stage in stadium formation, allowing the bidders an unobstructed view. Though the room was crowded, only a few of the seats were taken. Instead, most of the people wandered the room, examining photographs of some of the most valuable art. The photographs stood on easels along the walls, together with information about the artist, prices of the artist's work achieved in other auctions, along with estimated values. Other visitors clustered around the four podiums on either side of the entrance, piled high with catalogs that described the entire collection. Sophia moved through the room, Luke by her side, feeling slightly stunned. Not just because this was once all Ira's, but because of the collection itself. There were works by Picasso and Warhol, Johns and Pollock, Rauschenberg and de Kooning, exhibited side by side. Some were pieces that she'd never read or even heard about. Nor had the rumors of their value been exaggerated. She gasped at some of the estimates, only to discover that the next set of paintings was worth even more. Through it all, she found herself trying to reconcile those numbers with Ira, the sweet old man who'd written about nothing but the love he still felt for his wife. Luke's thoughts seemed to mirror her own, for he reached for her hand and murmured,
"There was nothing in his letter about this."
"Maybe none of this mattered to him," she said, baffled. "But really, how could it not?" When Luke failed to answer, she squeezed his hand. "I wish we could have helped him more."
"I don't know that there was any more that we could have done."
"Still."
His blue eyes searched hers.
"You read the letter," he said. "That's what he wanted. And I think that's why you and I were meant to find him. Who else would have waited around?"
When the announcement was made for people to take their seats, Luke and Sophia found a couple of empty ones in the back row. From there, it was almost impossible to see the easel, which disappointed Sophia. It would have been great to be able to see some of the paintings up close, but she knew those seats should go to prospective buyers, and the last thing she wanted was for someone to tap her on the shoulder and ask her to move later. A few minutes after that, men and women in suits began to take their seats behind the phones on the elevated tables, and slowly but surely, the overhead lights began to dim as a series of spotlights beamed down to illuminate the stage. Sophia scanned the crowd, spotting her two art history professors, including her advisor. As the clock approached one, the room slowly grew quieter, the hushed murmur gradually fading out completely, when a silver-haired gentleman in an exquisitely tailored suit strolled to the podium. In his hands, he held a folder, and he spread it wide before reaching into his breast pocket for his reading glasses. He propped them on his nose, adjusting the pages as he did so.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank all of you for coming to the auction of the extraordinary collection of Ira and Ruth Levinson. As you know, it's unusual for our firm to host such an event in venues other than our own, but in this case, Mr. Levinson didn't leave us much choice. It's also rather unorthodox for the particulars of today's auction to have remained somewhat vague. To begin, I'd like to explain the rules regarding this particular auction. Beneath each of the seats is a numbered paddle, and..."
He went on to describe the bidding process, but with her thoughts drifting to Ira again, Sophia tuned it out. Only vaguely did she hear the list of those who'd chosen to attend the auction. Curators from the Whitney and MoMA, the Tate, and countless others from cities overseas. She guessed that most of the people in the room were representatives of either private collectors or galleries, no doubt hoping to acquire something extremely rare. After the rules were outlined and certain individuals and institutions thanked, the silver-haired gentleman focused the attention of the audience again.
At this time, it is my pleasure to introduce to you Howie Sanders. Mr. Sanders served as Ira Levinson's attorney for many years, and has prepared some remarks he'd like to share with you as well.
Sanders appeared then, a bent, elderly figure whose dark wool suit hung off his bony frame. Slowly, he made his way to the podium. There, he cleared his throat before launching into his speech in a voice that was remarkably vigorous and clear.
We're gathered here today to participate in an extraordinary event. After all, it is very unusual for a collection of this size and significance to go unnoticed and unremarked upon for so many years. Until 6 years ago, I suspect that very few in this room even knew of the existence of this collection. The circumstances of its creation, the how, so to speak, were described in a magazine article, and yet I admit that even I, the man who served as Ira Levinson's attorney for the past 40 years, have been astounded by the cultural importance and value of this collection.
He paused to look up at the audience before going on.
But that is not why I'm here. I'm here because Ira was explicit in his instructions regarding this auction, and he asked me to say a few words to all of you. I confess that this is something I would rather not have been asked to do. Though I am comfortable in a courtroom or in the confines of my office, I am rarely required to face an audience of this nature, where many of you have been charged with the responsibility of securing a specific piece of art for a client or an institution at a price that even I have difficulty comprehending. And yet, because my friend Ira asked me to speak, I now find myself in this unenviable position.
A few good-natured chuckles were audible from the audience.
What can I tell you about Ira? That he was a good man? An honest, conscientious man? That he was a man who adored his wife? Or should I tell you about his business, or the quiet wisdom he exuded whenever we were together? I asked myself all these questions in an effort to discern what it was that Ira really wanted me to say to all of you. What would he have said if he, not I, had been standing before you? Ira, I think, would have said this to you. I want all of you to understand.
He let the comment hang, making sure he had their attention.
There is a wonderful quote I came across, he went on. It's attributed to Pablo Picasso, and as most of you probably realize, he's the only non-American artist whose work will be featured in today's auction. Years ago, Picasso was quoted as saying, "We all know that art is not truth. Art is a lie that makes us realize truth, at least the truth that is given us to understand."
He faced the audience again, his voice softening.
"Art is a lie that makes us realize truth, at least the truth that is given us to understand," he repeated. "I want you to think about that."
He scanned the auditorium, searching the faces of the hushed audience.
"I find that statement profound on a number of levels. Obviously, it speaks to the way in which you might view the art that you will examine here today. Upon reflection, however, I began to wonder whether Picasso was speaking simply about art, or whether he wanted us to view our own lives through that prism as well. What was Picasso suggesting? To me, he was saying that our reality is shaped by our perceptions. That something is good or bad only because we, you and I, believe it to be so based on our own experiences. And yet, Picasso is also saying that it's a lie. In other words, our opinions and our thoughts and feelings, anything we experience, need not define us forever. I realize that to some of you it may seem that I've strayed into a speech about moral relativism, while the rest of you probably think I'm just an old man who's gone completely off the rails here.
Again, the audience laughed.
But I'm here to tell you that Ira would have been pleased by my selection of this quote. Ira believed in good and evil, right and wrong, love and hate. He'd grown up in a world, in a time, where destruction and hate were evident on a worldwide scale. And yet Ira never let it define him or the man he strove daily to be. Today, I want you to view this auction as a memorial of sorts to all that he found important. But most of all, I hope you understand.
Sophia wasn't quite sure what to make of Sanders' speech, and glancing around, she wasn't sure that anyone else was either. While he spoke, she'd noticed a number of people texting on their phones, while others studied the catalog. There was a short break then as the silver-haired gentleman conferred with Sanders before the auctioneer returned to the podium. Again, he put on his reading glasses and cleared his throat.
As most of you are aware, the auction has been scheduled in phases, the first of which will be happening today. At this point, we have not determined either the number or timing of the subsequent phases, as those will no doubt be affected by the progress today. And now, I know that many of you have been waiting for the parameters of the auction itself.
Almost as one, the crowd began to lean forward in attention.
The parameters, again, were set by the client. The auction agreement was quite specific in a number of unusual details, including the order in which the pieces would be offered today. Per the instructions that all of you received in advance, we will now adjourn for 30 minutes to allow you to discuss the order with your clients. As a reminder, the list of paintings that are definitively being offered today can be found on pages 34 through 96 of the catalog. They are also represented in the photographs along the walls. In addition, the auction order will be listed on the screen.
People rose from their seats, reaching for phones. Others began to confer. Luke leaned over to whisper in Sophia's ear.
Do you mean that no one here knew the order of the works? What if the one they wanted didn't come up for sale until the end? They could be here for hours.
For such an extraordinary opportunity, they'd probably wait until the end of time. He motioned toward the easels lining the wall.
So which one do you want?
Because I have a few hundred dollars in my wallet and a numbered paddle beneath my seat here. The Picasso? The Jackson Pollock? One of the Warhols?
I wish.
Do you think that the sale prices will approach the estimates?
I have no idea, but I'm pretty sure the auction house has a good handle on that. It'll probably be close.
A few of those paintings are worth more than 20 of my ranches.
I know, right?
That's crazy.
Maybe, she admitted. He swiveled his head, taking in the scene.
I wonder what Ira would think about all this.
She recalled the old man she'd met in the hospital, and the letter, which never mentioned the art at all. I wonder, she said, whether he would even care. When the break was over and everyone was back in their seats, the silver-haired gentleman stepped toward the podium. In that instant, two men gingerly carried a covered painting to the easel on the stage. While Sophia expected a palpable buzz of interest now that the auction was getting underway, she realized when surveying the room that only a few people seemed to care. Again, she saw them tapping away on their phones while the speaker prepared his introduction. She knew that the first major work, one of the de Koonings, was scheduled to go second, and that the Jasper Johns was scheduled to go sixth. In between were artists Sophia had a harder time identifying, and this was no doubt one of them.
First up is a painting that can be found on page 34 of the catalog. It is oil on canvas, 24 by 30 inches, that Levinson, not the artist, called Portrait of Ruth. Ruth, as most of you are aware, was Ira Levinson's wife.
Both Sophia and Luke snapped to attention, focusing on the easel as the painting was unveiled. Behind it, magnified, was the painting projected on screen. Even with her untrained eye, Sophia could tell it had been painted by a child.
It was composed by an American, Daniel McCallum, born 1953, died 1986. Exact date of the painting is unknown, though it is estimated to date anywhere from 1965 to 1967. According to Ira Levinson's description of the item, Daniel was a former student of Ruth's, and it had been gifted to Mr. Levinson by McCallum's widow in 2002.
As it was described, Sophia stood to get a better view. Even from a distance, she knew it was the work of an amateur, but after reading the letter, she'd found herself wondering what Ruth had looked like. Despite the crudeness of the rendering, Ruth still appeared to be beautiful, with a tenderness of expression that reminded her of Ira. The speaker went on.
There is little else known about the artist, and he is not known to have created additional pieces. For those who did not make arrangements to view the piece yesterday, you are allowed at this time to approach the stage to study the painting. Bidding will commence in 5 minutes.
No one moved,
and Sophia knew that no one would. Instead, she could hear the rise of conversation, some people chatting while others quietly suppressed the nerves they were feeling at the next item up for bid, when the real auction would start. The 5 minutes passed slowly. The man at the podium showed no surprise. Instead, he thumbed through the papers in front of him, seemingly no more interested than anyone else. Even Luke seemed disengaged, which surprised her, considering that he, too, had heard Ira's letter. When the time was up, the speaker called for silence.
Portrait of Ruth by Daniel McCallum. We will commence the bidding at $1,000, he said. 1,000. Do I hear 1,000?
No one in the audience moved. At the podium, the silver-haired man registered no reaction.
Do I hear 900?
Please note that this is a chance to own part of one of the greatest private collections ever assembled. Nothing.
Do I hear 800?
Then, after a few beats,
do I hear 700? 600?
With every drop, Sophia felt something slowly begin to give way inside her. Somehow it wasn't right. She thought again of the letter Ira had written to Ruth, the letter that told her how much she'd meant to him.
Do I hear $500? 400?
And in that instant, from the corner of her eye, she saw Luke raise his paddle.
$400,
he called out, and the sound of his voice seemed to ricochet off the walls. Although a few people in the audience turned, they appeared only mildly curious.
We have $400. 400. Do I hear 450?
Again, the room remained silent. Sophia felt suddenly dizzy.
Going once, going twice, and sold.
Luke was approached by an attractive brunette holding a clipboard, who requested his information before explaining that it was also time to settle. She asked for his banking information, or the form he had filled out earlier.
I didn't fill out any forms, Luke demurred.
How do you wish to settle?
Would you take cash?
The woman smiled.
That will be fine, sir. Please follow me.
Luke walked off with the woman and returned a few minutes later holding his receipt. He took a seat beside Sophia, a sly grin on his face.
Why?
She asked.
I'd be willing to bet that this painting was the one that Ira liked best of all.
He shrugged.
It was the first one up for sale. And besides, he loved his wife and it was a portrait of her, and it didn't seem right that no one wanted it.
She considered that. If I didn't know you better, I'd think you were becoming a romantic.
I think,
he said slowly,
that Ira was the romantic. I'm just a washed-up bull rider.
You're more than that, she said, nudging him. Where are you going to hang it?
I don't even know that it really matters, do you? Besides, I don't even know where I'll be living in a few months.
Before she could respond, she heard a gavel come down before the speaker leaned into the microphone again.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time and before we go on, per the parameters of the auction, I'd like to reintroduce Howie Sanders, who wishes to read a letter from Ira Levinson in Ira's own words regarding the purchase of this item.
Sanders emerged from behind the curtain, shuffling in his oversized suit, an envelope in his hand. The silver-haired gentleman stepped aside to make room at the microphone. Sanders used a letter opener to slit open the top before pulling out the letter. He took a deep breath and then slowly unfolded it. He scanned the room and took a sip of water. He turned serious then, like an actor readying himself for a particularly dramatic scene, before finally beginning to read.
My name is Ira Levinson, and today you will hear my love story. It isn't the kind you might imagine. It's not a story with heroes and villains. It is not a story of handsome princes or princesses yet to be. Instead, it's a story about a simple man named Ira who met an extraordinary woman named Ruth. We met when we were young and fell in love. In time, we married and made a life together. A story like so many others, except Ruth happened to have an eye for art, while I had eyes only for her. And somehow this was enough for us to create a collection that became priceless to both of us. For Ruth, the art was about beauty and talent. For me, the art was simply a reflection of Ruth. And in this fashion, we filled our house and lived a long and happy life with each other. And then, all too soon,
It was over, and I found myself alone in a world that no longer made any sense.
Sanders stopped to wipe his tears, and to Sophia's surprise, she heard his voice begin to crack. He cleared his throat, and Sophia leaned forward, suddenly interested in what Sanders was saying.
This wasn't fair to me. Without Ruth, I had no reason to go on. And then, something miraculous happened. A portrait of my wife arrived, an unexpected gift, and when I hung it on my wall, I had the strange sense that Ruth was watching over me once more, helping me, guiding me. And little by little, the memories of my life with her were restored, memories that were tied to every piece in our collection. To me, these memories have always been more valuable than the art. It isn't possible for me to give those away, and yet, if the art was hers and the memories were mine, what was I supposed to do with the collection? I understood this dilemma, but the law did not, and for a long time I didn't know what to do. Without Ruth, after all, I was nothing. I loved her from the moment I met her, and even though I'm gone, you must know that I loved her with the final breath I took. More than anything, I want you to understand this simple truth. Though the art is beautiful and valuable almost beyond measure, I would have traded it all for just one more day with the wife I always adored.
Sanders studied the crowd. In their seats, everyone had gone still. Something was happening. Something out of the ordinary. Sanders seemed to realize this as well, and perhaps in anticipation he seemed to choke up. He brought a forefinger to his lips before going on.
Just one more day, Sanders said again, letting the words hang before going on. But how can I make all of you believe that I would have done such a thing? How can I convince you that I cared nothing about the commercial value of the art? How can I prove to you how special Ruth really was to me? How will you never forget that my love for her was at the heart of every piece we ever purchased?
Sanders glanced at the vaulted ceiling before coming back to all of them.
Will the individual who purchased Portrait of Ruth please stand?
By then, Sophia could barely breathe. Her heart was pounding as Luke rose to his feet. She felt the attention of the entire audience on him.
The terms of my will and the auction are simple. I have decided that whoever bought the Portrait of Ruth would receive the art collection in its entirety, effective immediately. And because it is no longer mine to offer, the rest of the auction is hereby canceled.
33. Luke. Luke couldn't move. As he stood in the back row, he sensed a stunned silence in the room. It took several seconds for Ira's words to register, not only for Luke, but for everyone present. Sanders couldn't have been serious. Or if he had been serious, then Luke had misunderstood him. Because what it sounded like to Luke was that he'd just acquired the entire collection. But that wasn't possible. It couldn't be possible. Could it? His thoughts seemed mirrored by the audience itself. He saw baffled expressions and frowns of incomprehension, people throwing up their hands, faces showing shock and confusion, maybe even betrayal. And then, after that, pandemonium. It wasn't the chair-throwing variety of riot witnessed so often at sporting events, but the controlled rage of the entitled and self-important. A man in the third row in the center section stood and threatened to call his attorney. Another cried that he'd been brought here under false pretenses and would be calling his attorney as well. Still another insisted that fraud had been committed. The outrage and anger in the room began to rise, first slowly and then explosively. More people rose to their feet and began shouting at Sanders. Another group focused their attention on the silver-haired gentleman. On the far side of the room, one of the easels crashed to the ground, the result of someone storming from the room. And then, all at once, faces began to turn to Luke. He felt the mob's anger and disappointment and betrayal. But he also sensed in some of them a pointed suspicion. In still others, there glinted the light of opportunity. An attractive blonde in a form-fitting business suit edged closer, and then all at once, seats were pushed aside as throngs of people began to rush toward Luke,
everyone calling out at once.
Excuse me?
Can we talk?
I'd like to schedule a meeting with you.
What are you going to do with the Warhol?
My client is particularly interested in one of the Rauschenbergs.
Instinctively, Luke grabbed Sophia's hand and pushed back his chair, making room for their escape. An instant later, they were dashing toward the door, the audience in pursuit. He pushed open the doors, only to find 6 security guards standing behind 2 women and a man wearing badges of the sponsoring auction house. One of them was the same attractive woman who had taken his information and almost all the cash he'd had in his wallet.
Mr. Collins, she asked, my name is Gabrielle and I work for the auction house. We have a private room for you upstairs. We anticipated that it might get a little hectic, so we made special arrangements for your comfort and security. Would you please follow me?
I was thinking of just heading to my truck.
There's some additional paperwork, as you can probably imagine. Please, if you wouldn't mind.
She gestured toward the hallway. Luke looked back at the approaching crowd.
Let's go,
he decided. Still clutching Sophia's hand, he turned and followed Gabrielle, flanked by 3 of the guards. Luke realized that the others had remained behind to keep the audience from following them. He could vaguely hear them shouting at him, bombarding him with questions. He had the surreal impression that someone was playing a practical joke on him, though to what end he had no idea. It was crazy. All of this was crazy. Their group turned the corner and headed through a door leading to the staircase. When Luke turned to peek over his shoulder, he realized that only 2 of the guards remained with them. The other stayed behind to guard the door. On the 2nd floor, he and Sophia were led to a set of wood-paneled doors, which Gabrielle opened for them.
Please, she said, ushering them into a spacious suite of rooms. Make yourselves comfortable. We have refreshments and food inside, along with the catalog. I'm sure you have 1,000 questions, and I can assure you that they will all be answered.
What's going on?
Luke asked. She raised an eyebrow.
I think you already know, she said, without directly answering the question.
She turned toward Sophia and offered her hand.
I'm afraid I didn't catch your name.
Sophia, she said. Sophia Danko. Gabrielle tilted her head.
Slovakian, yes? A beautiful country. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Then, turning to Luke again,
the guards will be posted outside the room so you don't have to worry about anyone disturbing you. For now, I'm sure you have a lot to think about and discuss. We'll leave you alone for a few minutes to review your collection. Would that be all right?
I guess,
Luke said, his mind still spinning.
But
Mr. Lehman and Mr. Sanders will be in shortly.
Luke lifted an eyebrow at Sophia before surveying the well-appointed room. Couches and chairs surrounded a low, round table. On the table stood an assortment of drinks, including a bucket of champagne on ice, a platter of sandwiches, and a sliced fruit and cheese selection on a crystal dish. Next to the table lay the catalog, opened to a particular page. Behind them, the door closed, and Luke found himself alone with Sophia. She glanced at him, then cautiously approached the table and studied the open catalog page.
It's Ruth, she said, touching the page.
He watched as she ran her finger lightly over the photograph.
This can't really be happening, can it?
She continued to stare at the photograph before turning toward him with a dazed and beatific smile.
Yes, she said.
I think it's really happening.
Gabrielle returned with Mr. Sanders and Mr. Lehman, whom Luke recognized as the silver-haired gentleman who'd presided over the auction. After Sanders introduced himself, he took a seat in the chair and blew his nose in a linen handkerchief. Up close, Luke noticed the wrinkles and bushy white eyebrows. He suspected the man was somewhere in his mid-70s. Yet a hint of mischief underlay his expression, making him seem younger.
Before we begin, let me address the first and most obvious question that I'm sure you've been pondering,
Sanders began, resting his hands on his knees.
You're probably wondering, is there a catch? Did you, by purchasing the portrait of Ruth, indeed inherit the entire collection? Am I correct?
That's pretty much it, Luke admitted.
Ever since the commotion in the auditorium, he'd felt utterly at sea. This setting, these people, nothing could have felt more foreign to him.
The answer to your question is yes, Sanders said in a kindly voice. According to the terms of Ira Levinson's will, the purchaser of that particular piece, Portrait of Ruth, was to receive the entire collection. That is why it was offered for sale first. In other words, there is no catch. There are no strings attached. The collection is now yours to do with as you wish.
So I could ask you to just load it up in the back of my truck and I could bring it all back to my house? Right now?
Yes, Sanders answered. Though, considering the size of the collection, it would likely take a number of trips. And given the value of some of the artwork, I would recommend a safer mode of transportation.
Luke stared at him, dumbfounded.
There is, however, an issue which you will have to consider.
Here it comes, Luke thought.
It concerns estate taxes, Sanders said.
As you may or may not be aware, any bequest in excess of a certain amount is subject to taxation by the United States government, or the IRS.
The value of the collection is far in excess of that amount, which means that you now have substantial tax obligations that you will have to meet.
Unless you're worth a fortune, and a large fortune at that,
with substantial liquid assets to cover these taxes, you will most likely have to sell a portion of the collection to meet them. Perhaps even half of the collection. It depends, of course, on which pieces you choose to sell. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think so. I inherited a lot, and I've got to pay taxes on it.
Exactly. So before we go any further, I'd like to ask whether you have an estate attorney with whom you prefer to deal. If not, I am happy to make recommendations.
I don't have anyone.
Sanders nodded.
I suspected you didn't. You're rather young. That's fine, of course.
He dug in his pocket for a business card.
If you call my office on Monday morning, I will provide a list. You are not required, of course, to use any of the names I suggest.
Luke inspected the card.
It says here that you're an estate attorney.
I am. In the past, I served in other areas, but estate work suits me these days.
Then could I hire you?
If you wish, he said.
He motioned toward the others in the room.
You've already met Gabrielle. She's a vice president of client relationships at the auction house. I also wanted you to meet David Lehman. He's the president of the auction house.
Luke shook his hand and exchanged pleasantries before Sanders went on.
As you can probably imagine, arranging the auction in this manner was challenging in many respects, including a financial one. Mr. Lehman's auction house is the one that Ira Levinson preferred. While you are not obligated to use them in the future, as Ira and I were working out the details, he asked me to request that the purchaser strongly consider his pre-existing relationship with them. They are considered one of the top auction houses in the world, which I think your own research will bear out.
Luke searched the faces surrounding them, reality slowly sinking in.
Okay,
he said.
But I couldn't make that kind of decision without talking to my attorney.
I think that's a wise decision, Sanders said. Though we're here to answer any questions, I would recommend you retain an attorney sooner rather than later. You will benefit from a professional to guide you through what will likely be a rather complicated process, not just concerning the estate, but other areas of your life as well. After all, you are now, even after you pay the taxes, an incredibly wealthy man. So please, ask any questions you wish.
Luke met Sophia's eyes, then turned back to Sanders.
How long were you Ira's attorney?
Over 40 years,
he answered with a trace of wistfulness.
And if I hire an attorney, that attorney would represent me to the best of his or her ability?
Since you are their client, they would be obligated to.
So maybe, Luke said, we should just get that out of the way right now.
How do I hire you? In case I want to talk to Mr. Lehman here.
You'd need to provide me with a retainer.
How much would that be?
Luke wrinkled his brow in concern.
For now, Sanders said, I think a single dollar would be sufficient.
Luke drew a long breath, finally coming to terms with the enormity of it all. The wealth. The ranch. The life he could create with Sophia.
With that, Luke pulled out his wallet and inspected its contents.
There wasn't much left after purchasing the portrait. Just enough to buy a couple of gallons of gasoline.
Or maybe less, since he used part of it to retain Howie Sanders. Epilogue. In the months that followed the auction, Luke sometimes felt himself to be acting out a part in a fantasy that someone else had scripted for him. On